Wallop Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Gerrard. Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we are going to talk about the world's greatest disasters.
Sounds like a good idea.
What went wrong?
Excellent.
How it went wrong?
Sounds good.
And whether it was our fault.
Our fault.
Or God's fault.
Bloody God's fault. And remember, Phil, it's not our intention to make fun of the sometimes quite high mortality rates in some of these disasters, is it?
No.
We're just interested in finding out what went wrong, isn't it? And be honest with yourself, Phil, if it came on the news, you'd be interested, wouldn't you?
Not half.
What are we wanging on about this week?
The Zeebrugge ferry disaster.
Before our next programme, we're going over now to the newsroom for a report from Nicholas Witchell.
Good evening. We're getting reports that a ferry with more than 600 people on board has capsized off the coast of Belgium. The vessel is the Herald of Free Enterprise. She's part of the Townsend Torreson fleet. She was on her way from Zeebrugge to Dover. It's believed she left Zeebrugge sometime after 7 o'clock this evening. The Dover Coast Guard says she was carrying 590 passengers and some 60 crew. She's at present lying on her side about a mile from the entrance to Zeebrugge Harbour. We'll have more details on that story in the 9 o'clock news.
Do you think it's worthwhile doing a warning?
I think so, because it's relatively current.
Yeah.
In terms of it's well within living memory.
Yeah.
There's a lot of survivors, a lot of people who are affected by the disaster still around.
Yeah.
It is actually, when you look into it, horrendous.
It's worse than you remember. Going through the research for this podcast, I don't remember it being quite this horrible. So it was a surprise. Was it a surprise to you when you were researching?
It was, but I sort of wonder why it should be.
Yeah.
Because if you've got a ferry full of people that turns on a 90-degree angle into the sea, how could that be anything but utterly horrendous? But you don't think about it. You don't go, oh, well, that must mean that...
It doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that.
Don't... I mean, it's probably half our fault for trying to do essentially a light-hearted podcast about subjects that are in no way light-hearted.
I think we're doing terribly well. If we could get through the Princess Alice disaster, Phil, we could get through this.
If we could get through drowning in poo.
Okay, so Philip Lucas, for the first time in this podcast, the Zeebrugge ferry disaster. What was it?
It was the sinking of the cross-channel ferry, the Herald of Free Enterprise, not long after leaving Zeebrugge Harbour in Belgium.
When did it happen?
The 6th of March 1987.
And how many people died?
193, making it Britain's worst maritime disaster since the Titanic.
See, that's mad, isn't it? Because the Titanic is so famous.
Mm.
And there are, I think, parts of this disaster which are worse than the Titanic.
Mm.
The Titanic sank much, much slower.
Slower, yeah.
And it sank level. It tipped up on
its
bow.
You had time on the Titanic to think about.
Yes,
what
to work out.
I mean,
happening.
Not in any way belittling the over 1,000 people.
Oh, no, the Titanic is horrific, an absolutely horrific disaster, but it doesn't have this...
This immediacy.
It doesn't have the immediacy. Mm. It doesn't have the destabilising effect of, like, I was sat in a restaurant and now I'm on a climbing frame, which is what happens in Zeebrugge.
I like how two middle-class men who have never experienced any trauma in their life can sit here and rank disasters and say, yeah, well, that is absolutely much worse.
I'm not saying it's worse. I'm just saying there are elements of it.
I see what you mean.
You didn't have
any time to react to this one, as we'll find out.
So, give me some background on Zeebrugge, Philip Lucas.
So, the Herald of Free Enterprise was a roll-on, roll-off ferry that entered service in 1980 to go back and forth across the English Channel. It was owned by a company called Townsend Torreson, who not a lot of people know are actually owned by P&O. At the time of this accident.
I didn't know that. So they basically had, they had a mega rebranding because of this.
Mm.
Was it because of this disaster?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you know what a roll-on, roll-off ferry is?
Well, I've been on one, I guess. They open the front, you drive on.
That's it. It's a ferry that is designed to carry cars and lorries. So you drive on the ship and off the ship, normally, you know, on the back, off the front, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Roll-on, roll-off.
Yeah. Just loads of bloke. Oh, yeah, this way. That way.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they all are across the English Channel.
They're very utilitarian ferries, aren't they? There's no real bells and whistles. It's a big steel box with an opening at each end. Yeah. There's no frills.
Do you want stats on it?
Yeah, stat me up, mate.
Tons.
Oh.
Ship tonnage, 7,951, so 8,000 tons ship.
Is that big?
Not massively, quite small by today's standards.
What was the Titanic?
47,000 tons. If you were to imagine a modern cross-channel ferry, that is about half the size, maybe even a little bit smaller.
Oh, it's small for a ferry?
It's quite small for a ferry, but quite normal for that age.
Oh, okay.
Things have got bigger.
Give me its length, mate.
Length, 131 metres.
Not that big.
Not that big. A beam.
Remember, side to side.
Side to side from the widest part.
This is interesting for this as well, because this becomes height.
23 metres.
Yeah, so 23 metres. So what becomes a 23 metre wide ship becomes a 23 metre tall drop.
Yes. Top speed, 22 knots.
That means nothing.
Roughly miles per hour.
Oh! Why did they just say miles per hour?
Because they're salty sea dogs. They do things differently.
How many people could you get on this?
About 1,400.
Back them in, 1,400. That's a lot.
She had 8 decks. Ships are always she.
Is there anything that's a bloke?
I don't think
a
many...
bike's men?
I don't think
he's
many
got
modes
a flat tire again. Nothing's a man, is it?
No, most modes of transport are ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't know why.
There's something weird about saying he, isn't there, I suppose?
Yeah, this is me rally chopper, Gary.
Yeah, that's right.
So, she had 8 decks. Mm-hmm. Because she was designed for rapid loading and unloading on these very competitive cross-channel route, there was no watertight compartments.
Right.
Now, that sounds weird and worrying. That's perfectly normal for these kind of things. It did obviously have watertight doors at the bow and the stern, which are front and back.
Because ferries are the sorts of ships where you go across a bit of water that's no problem, isn't it? You just go, it's no problem, bit of water, and you go backwards and forwards. No one ever worries about a ferry journey.
You just don't think. And also, I think there's a subconscious thing where you go, this is Britain. You sort of go, these people know what they're doing. They do this all day long.
Yeah, but then you meet a British person and you go, oh, shit. Yeah. No, they've got no idea what's going on.
That's when you meet them and go, thank God for procedure.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Phil, that is my ship stats. What happened on the day of this disaster?
The Herald of Free Enterprise was working the route between Dover and the Belgian port of Zeebrugge.
Mm-hmm.
How far is that?
It was about 4.5 hours travel.
Oh,
it's quite a long journey, really. Yeah, one of the longest. Incidentally, do you know that Zeebrugge translates as Bruges on sea?
Oh, how lovely.
Mm.
Oh, it's a little bit of Bruges.
Very near.
On sea.
Very near Bruges.
Okay. The ship, like all cross-channel ferries, to be fair, was on a tight schedule.
Mm.
She had to complete 4 crossings a day.
Which, when it's 4.5 hours per crossing,
that's
virtually a 24-hour operation, isn't
it? Yeah, you've got to pretty much piss it across, get it back, get it going, to make the money. In fact, the captain and the first officer would be reprimanded by their bosses if the ferry arrived even just a few minutes late.
So pressure immediately on every cruise, every trip.
Every single
pressure.
Trip. They're knowing if they're even minutes late, they're going to get it in the arse from their boss.
It's like planes. Planes have such a tight turnaround time, which is why Ryanair are so quick at turning their planes around.
Because the margins are so tight, right?
Plane only makes money when it's in the air.
Like tubes, you know, like tube trains are so often and so frequent that if they have to open and close the doors once, that's like a delay for the rest of the day, right?
It throws everything off.
Okay, so at 4 p.m, the ship was sitting at the port of Zeebrugge getting ready to leave for Dover. The assistant bosun. Why is it written boxwain?
Because that's how they spell it, because nautical people do things differently.
Okay.
Bosun.
I've never in my life known that the word bosun was written boxwain.
I'm not sure I've seen it written as bosun.
Well, like core, like flying core.
Oh, yeah.
Is it core or corpse? The flying corpse.
Yeah.
A flying corpse is a very different thing. Assistant bosun.
Bosun.
Mark Stanley.
Very important name to remember in this.
Okay, Mark Stanley was finishing up cleaning the car deck for the return trip to England. At this time, Stanley had been on duty for more than 5 hours. He was well into his shift, probably a bit tired. But he's due an hour break before the ship sails. He won't be needed on the car deck again until the ship sails at 6 o'clock. That's important, right? He's a bit tired. He's getting to the end of his shift. That afternoon, the vessel was at about 40% capacity. Although, for some reason, news reports state that it was full. Do you think they're doing that just to...
I don't know. There's a real dichotomy when you research this. But I think, in all honesty, it was not full, but it was, about 40%.
I wonder why they did that. What a strange thing to do. It's already horrible. Why bump it up and say it was packed?
Mm.
Okay. The ship was mostly carrying passengers from the UK, many of whom were on a Sun newspaper £1 day trip offer.
I remember those.
Yeah, do they still do them?
I don't know. They do £9 holidays now, don't they?
I haven't looked at a copy of the Sun for years.
We did a £9 Sun holiday this year.
Oh, what was it like?
It ends up costing about £120 by the time you put the extras on. But it was fine.
You want wheels on it?
Yeah. To be fair, it was a place we'd been to before, so we knew the place was all right.
What was the place?
It's a place in Dorset. What I call just a base for where we needed to go.
It was a hotel.
It was a holiday park.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, no, it was nice. It was nice. But by the time you pay your £9,
yeah.
And then, oh, do you want bedding? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but still cheap.
Do you want the normal things that human beings need to stay alive? £150, mate.
You know this thing about saying that mostly Brits are on board?
Yeah.
Doesn't surprise me. You don't get Europeans on ferries coming over here.
No.
It doesn't happen. It's normally, whenever I've caught a cross-channel ferry, and I'm not saying against this particular day, because I don't know, but whenever I've caught a cross-channel ferry, it is a disappointing affair at best. It's lorry drivers, people on booze cruises, and I have to be honest, Phil, people who can't afford the Eurostar.
Oh, well, what about people getting their posh, expensive cars over to the south of France?
There's a little bit of that, but they tend to sit in the corner looking quite disparaging.
That's right, not looking around, trying not to touch anything.
Yeah.
At 5 p.m, the cars and lorries were all starting to load. We've all been in this situation. Mm. You sat, it's miserable, and you just wait, don't you, to be called onto the ferry. It's interesting that this is such a bad, because when you're sitting waiting to go on, like, to the Isle of Wight or something on the ferry, I don't give 2 seconds thought to that ferry. I'm sat in my car, it's a ball ache. It's nothing but a ball ache. And there's no part of me that ever think that I was approaching anything dangerous.
No.
A big diesel smelling, boring experience.
It's as boring as buying rice.
Isn't it?
Mm.
Now, the ship takes vehicles on 2 levels.
Mm.
Okay, E deck, which is the upper vehicle deck, and G deck, which is the main vehicle deck. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, once the lower main deck is full, the crew then start filling the upper deck.
Mm.
Okay? But there's a problem here, because the loading ramp at Zeebrugge couldn't reach the upper deck.
Mm.
So to reduce the gap, the captain had to lower the ship in the water, and he did that by pumping seawater into the ballast tanks to lower the whole ship down.
Yeah, so ship gets heavier with the ballast.
So it can reach the gangplank.
Yeah.
Which, again, seems a bit of a weird thing to do, to fill your ship up with water so that you can... You know, you'd think that they would raise the plank rather than lower the ship.
Well, but you'd think they'd make a longer... Zeebrugge would have a longer ramp.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'll tell you, half the reason for this, I don't want to go off board, is that the ship wasn't actually designed for that route. It was designed more for the Dover-Calais route.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that had a bearing
on... So they were botching it a bit.
Well, it had done that route for a long time, but it wasn't really designed for that route.
They're kind of bodging it, trying to make it work.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't uncommon.
And
but...
it's not unsafe.
No.
Because ballast is a thing, isn't it? Okay, so after about 30 minutes of taking on ballast... Do you say taking on ballast?
Yes.
Okay. heave-ho me hearties. After 30 minutes, the ship was sinking 1 metre lower in the water and loading the upper deck.
Yeah, and the captain had done all that, put the ballast in, and he was having his fish fingers.
Lovely. Yeah, absolutely. Shepherding children around in a not uncreepy way. At 5:45, 15 minutes before they were about to leave, the crew were struggling to load the upper car deck on time. Because I guess lots of people turn up freaking late, don't they? The first officer, Leslie Sable... was in charge of loading, and he was feeling the pressure of trying to get all the cars on so they could go and not lose money and not get shouted at by the time they got back to Dover. As a crew member that day, Lee Cornelius remembered, Phil.
It's always a bit of a rush at the end. Cars turn up just before you're sailing. And I'm sorry, Phil, but there you have it.
Yeah.
Again.
You're squarely blaming the human element.
Oh, here we go. It's the general public, isn't it? It's their stupidity and inability to follow basic rules that lead you towards these delays. Now, when you're getting on a car ferry or anything like that, you'll have a timetable. They'll say, please, can you get to the port at this time? People don't do that. People rock up when they want, breeze in just at the last minute and expect the world to revolve. People make me sick.
Have you never done it? Have you never rocked up last minute to get on a ferry?
No.
I have. And I think it is because I'm just putting no thought into the ferry part of it.
People like you cause delays. People like me go...
You're there on time.
I am there on time. Normally I'm early.
Yeah, no, I'm late.
Ridiculously early,
I have begged to be let on a ferry before. To like, be, you know, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning and like I'm trying to get back over to... drive home, and I have like been that bastard in my car going, come on, mate, come on, it's there, I can see you, let me on.
I hate anyway, people
maybe
like
I won't do it from time to time. At 5:57 p.m. the crew finally finished loading, but that's too late. The ship wasn't able to depart on schedule that night, so they'd be like, ah, we fucked it. We're going to be shouted at. At 6:05, the ship's engine started and she started to leave. And about 5 minutes late departing. Doesn't sound like a lot, to be fair. At 6:24, the ship reached the outer boundary of the harbour and accelerated to 18 knots, 18 miles an hour. They're not far away from the harbour.
Very near.
Very, very, very close. Very, very near. 90 seconds later, and completely out of the blue, right, the ship lurches violently. And that would be scary, right, on a ferry. But I don't think I would be too worried. I just imagine it was a big wave or something. There's a bit of commotion with the passengers, but most think, like I said, it's a bit of rough sea and don't think anything more about it.
Well, I did see there was I watched a documentary about this, and one of the survivors said that when the first lurch happened, they kind of went for a few microseconds, like, oh my God, and then sort of just thought it was a wave, all raised their glasses and were like, "Hey, cheers."
Oh, no.
Because you just go, you know, rough sea or whatever.
You'd get a little, you'd get a little jolt, you'd get a little bit of adrenaline.
A bit like
What's that?
First bit of turbulence you get in a plane. You just go, whoa! Oh,
nervous laugh. Yeah. Ooh, what was that? Mm. You know, would you go out on deck at that point?
I don't think I'd just go, okay, I'll go and see what that was. You just go, oh, you wouldn't give it a second thought.
I don't think you'd give it a second thought.
No. And I think it showed most of the people I listened to when I was researching this were like, yeah, well, it was bad, but it was over so quick.
So it's lurching to the side.
Just did a quick lurch to the side, yeah.
The situation seemingly very soon returned to normal. But down below on the car deck, the lower car deck, I suppose, and on the bridge, something is going very badly wrong. The ship was starting to veer off course and the captain was wrestling with the controls, but the Herald of Free Enterprise just didn't respond. So they knew quite quickly on the bridge that something was going
wrong. Something was wrong very quickly.
Then on the lower car deck, a crew member alerted one of the assistant pursers that vast amounts of water was pouring down the stairs from the upper car deck. And the purser immediately called the bridge, but there was no response. So the first thing he saw is water pouring downstairs. Would he know at that point that the ship was going down?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But you would know something's wrong.
Yeah, that's right. If I went home and found out there was water pouring down my stairs, I'd be like, something's wrong. Because I haven't got stairs, to be fair. But like, yes.
You hope to arrive at the end of your ferry journey.
Yeah.
Go and pick your car up, and you hope that that deck is dry.
Yes, that's right. The one thing I expect the inside of a ship to be is dry.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like...
That's evolution.
It's like the one thing you don't want on a plane is it to be windy inside. It's a bit windy in this plane. I don't like that at all. The purser called the bridge, but there was no response. At that moment, there was another massive jolt, and the ship tilted a full 30 degrees to the left.
That's a hell of a lot, 30 degrees.
So now everybody knows something's going wrong.
Yeah, you think 30 degrees. So 90 degrees is essentially a right angle, isn't it? So 30 degrees, just under half of that.
Yeah.
But when you're on a ship, that's a hell of a
lot. That's knocking you off your feet.
Yeah.
That is more than anybody would expect from a big wave.
Oh, that's when you would crap yourself.
And they can see that it's probably quite a nice day. You know, if you look outside and it's not windy.
It's just getting dark.
But it's not, you know, they would know that it wasn't a windy day.
No, it wasn't that bad. It was quite calm.
The ship tilts a full 30 degrees to the left. It threw the captain to the floor and knocked him unconscious. Things are getting particularly bad.
People
now.
Are screwed, aren't they?
Knocking the captain unconscious seems like a really unlucky move.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I don't think he could have done much because this all happened so quick.
Yes.
But, yeah, that's not great.
Right. The 8,000-tonne ship now starts to roll over. This is where it becomes the stuff of nightmares. There was a horrible grinding sound within the ship. The seawater had started breaking through the ship's portholes.
Well, it's now lilting over, isn't it?
Yeah.
So some of the portholes are in the sea.
Water is gushing through those portholes in jets. Fire engine jets of water are coming through portholes, essentially. Thousands of tons of ice-cold water gushed into the ship under tremendous pressure and at a huge speed. It's a rushing torrent of extremely cold water. Very, very quick, this is happening. To make matters worse, the water quickly reached the ship's electrical systems, destroying both main and emergency power and leaving the ship in darkness while this was happening.
That's
so
grim.
You're enjoying your bacon sandwich. You're having a very, very uneventful, boring even, ferry journey. And all of a second, you're lurching to the side. Ice cold water has started shooting into where you're sitting and it's dark. Lights have gone off.
That's...
It's the absolute stuff of nightmares. To get an idea of what this was like for the passengers, this is the memory of a survivor, a man called Simon Osborne, who was in the sixth form at the time.
One man cried out as he crashed through a glass panel just feet from where I stood, rooted to the spot, wide-eyed, frozen in fear. That's horrible.
Mr. Osborne said he realised he had a chance of survival when the water level stopped rising, but all he could hear were the cries of terror from other passengers, which are deafening. He described his eventual rescue as a harrowing scene, forcing himself through dead bodies and wreckage to find help. Mr. Osborne lost two friends in the disaster.
No.
So the thing that's really impressing on me is how quickly this is happening.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Mm. How quickly it's gone from absolute boredom to probably the defining moment of the rest of your life, really.
Mm. Yeah. No time to think about it. No. You can't prepare for it.
Immediately there's drowned people. Mm. Immediately there's, you know, you're immediately fighting for your life. Mm. It's something very different to the Titanic. The Titanic is a slow realisation that the ship is going down.
Yeah.
And so it's horrible, but it's not this insane split-second, you know, life or death situation.
Yeah.
So now, the ferry's entire left side is sinking into the North Sea and comes to a rest, leaving the ship three quarters underwater at a 90-degree angle. So it's on its side. Mm. It happened so quickly there was no time for the ship to even make a distress call. Now, if there's anything at all positive in all this horror, it's the reason why the ship is on its side at 90 degrees and then not capsized to the full 180.
Done the full Poseidon adventure thing, yeah.
Is that there was, because they weren't that far out of the
harbour. No.
So the water was quite shallow. And underneath the water, there was a sandbank. So the ship should stop capsizing any further because it had hit the sandbank. Mm. Inside the ferry, those who haven't already died were fighting for their survival in the dark and ice-cold waters of a ship where the floors, and this is the thing that I remember from being seven, I remember it terrifying me at the time, the floors have become walls.
Yeah.
And the walls have become floors. Mm. And so corridors, you know, you've been on a ferry, you'd have those long corridors. Mm. They're now chutes. They're wells, essentially.
Yeah.
You can't climb up them or climb
and
down
it's,
them.
And it's total darkness.
Total darkness, freezing cold, absolute chaos.
Oh.
One survivor, a lady called Teresa Parry, recalled the moment as she was floating in the water.
You could feel people holding onto your coat, holding onto your trousers and literally trying to climb over you. One of the worst things is you've got someone holding onto you and then all of a sudden they're gone. I don't know how you'd get over that.
So is she saying that she is in the water?
My understanding from her is that her coat was like a sort of puffer jacket thing, actually sort of acted as a bit of a life belt for her.
Yeah.
So she was floating and there were people
underneath her
holding on to try and keep alive, get a grip of something. But obviously as the water got colder and they would fall off. So she's essentially saying there are people, you know, dying. Okay. It's horrible. I'm sorry, guys. This is not nice.
it's the nature of the podcast.
It gets worse, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's the hypothermia element of it, which is what's happening to a lot of these people who are trying to cling on. Passengers who managed to survive at least the initial stage of the disaster were now dying from hypothermia. The North Sea water on that day was only a few degrees above freezing, 3 degrees centigrade. At that temperature, most people lose consciousness in about 20 minutes. That's nothing, is it?
No.
I mean, you can't survive in that water.
No. And that's not even taking account of the shock.
And being plunged into that water in the clothes that they're wearing, that a lot of them are wearing, because if it's cold, I mean, a lot of them are wearing lots of clothes, big heavy jackets, big, you know, jeans, big denim jackets, shoes, not stuff that you can, you know.
No, they're not prepared in frog suits.
Exactly.
And,
you know. But not even in like light clothing that you might, you know, if it was a summer's day.
Well, it was like the Princess Alice disaster we did, doesn't it? Everyone is in heavy clothes for the evening.
Yeah, exactly. You know, pulling them down.
Yeah.
God. So the temperature of the water means that people still alive within the ship needed to be rescued very quickly, or they would drown through lack of consciousness because, the water would knock them out and they would just sink into the water. Fortunately, by this stage, at 6:40, only 12 minutes since the ship keeled over, the authorities were aware of the accident because it's really close to the harbour, and a nearby tugboat made it to the Herald of Free Enterprise, and the crew started doing all they could to free the surviving passengers and pick up those who were already floating in the sea outside the ship. They were pretty good, weren't they, right?
The
rescue.
Yeah, once it kicked in, it was superb. In fact, there was a lot of gallantry medals given out for how good, and particularly the Belgian Navy were.
Really?
So
well, at least it wasn't compounded by that, because Tenerife was compounded by the fact that Although that wasn't really their fault. Within 20 minutes, Coast Guard helicopters were also on the scene and rescue ships were arriving all the time. Local divers turned up to help. It's incredibly dangerous to dive inside an unstable ship.
God, yeah.
But in that scenario, it really is the survivor's only chance if there was somebody to come in and help them out. Incidentally, the divers report that the bow doors of the ship appeared to be wide open. And this is the first idea of the first clue as to what's happened here. Mm. Pete Lagast, a diver from a local salvage company, was one of those volunteers, one of those brave divers. He made his way through floating bodies and wreckage, calling out to people in the dark. That's just a sinister, surreal scene. Pete said,
"With our lights out, we saw that people in the water were moving. We also saw people in the water who were motionless. So obviously we went for the people who were moving, those who put up their hands or arms or were calling, only because you knew those people were still alive." Ugh.
It would have been a very...
He probably wasn't a diver that was... he was a salvage diver, so he probably wasn't used to bodies as much, actually.
I mean, imagine scanning.
I get stressed if I cut my gums cleaning my teeth.
Yes, definitely.
You know, how do you...
I mean, you're a man who's scared of milk. So I don't know how you would deal with this. The scene at this moment from inside the ship was described by Simon Osborne. Do you remember the
sixth form student? Yeah. There were these people shouting, screaming, and as time went on, it just became less and less.
People are dying of hypothermia.
And also, people were dying of heart attacks because of the cold.
Been plunged in. Mm. Have you ever swam in extremely cold water?
Mm.
I was in Switzerland years and years and years ago when I was a teenager. And I went for a swim in a Lido. And it was cold when I first got in. You know when it's like funny cold because all your mates are there and you're like 16 and you're like, oh, mate, it's really cold. And push each other in. And then I swam out into the centre of the Lido, at least a bit further out. And I could feel my chest constricting. Mm. You can feel that it's doing
And you're
stuff.
A very unhealthy man.
Well, in those days, extremely unhealthy. I used to eat things we used to call jammy bastards, which was a jam sandwich, battered, deep fried, and then rolled in sugar.
Oh, Elvis Gerard.
Absolutely. So, yes, you can feel it. Now then, those divers were amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really, really amazing. What an incredible thing to do. Mm. And, you know, without them, the death toll would have been considerably higher. And that's also true of the Belgian Navy, as you said. By 9 o'clock, full dark now, I should imagine, 2.5 hours since the boat keeled over, rescuers were still finding survivors. But dead bodies were now outnumbering the living by quite a lot. By 11:30, hardly any more survivors were found. By 3 a.m., the rescue effort was suspended until dawn as the rising tides created dangerous currents inside the ship. Yeah. Waves inside the ship.
Just couldn't go in, could you?
In reality, any hope of finding any more survivors was over. So it's a very quick, really horrific ship capsize. What was happening away from the ship, Mr. Philip Lucas?
Well, away from the ship, we have to remember that the survivors are now in local hospitals or kind of makeshift centres. And, of course, they're waiting to get news of friends or loved ones that they've been separated from. Don't forget, when these things happened, it's not like a family is necessarily all sitting together so they could be all over the place.
Because everyone feels it's so safe.
Yeah. So many people here, you know, at this point are learning about their loved ones who didn't survive, you know, and others are waiting sometimes hours and hours for this sort of agonising news. At this point, it seems quite relevant, I think, to hear from a survivor called Gillian Lashbrook. She was 16 at the time of the disaster, and horribly she lost her mother, stepfather and uncle in this accident. But I think what she says here sort of helps us understand this experience a little bit more. She says, "I was outside the deck when it started, and I was looking over the rail into the water. The water was getting further away. At first, I thought I was imagining it. The ship just tilted over and I was flung backwards and knocked unconscious for a little while. And when I came round, I was lying on the seats. But they were in the wrong place because the ship had gone on its side. So the floor was now like a wall. I tried to climb up the seating like a ladder, but I couldn't. All I wanted to do was get back inside to my mum. Eventually, I jumped into the sea. I was wearing long boots and a denim coat. They were so heavy that they were dragging me down. I struggled to take off my boots and coat while I was still trying to swim. I thought I'd try and swim back to the land, but it was so cold and the waves were so ferocious. So I swam back to the boat and managed to hook my skirt onto something that was sticking out of the boat because the waves were dragging me down and I needed to stay up. There was this woman near me and she was holding a little girl above the water. Helicopters were overhead, but they couldn't see us. So I flung myself back into the sea and there was a fishing boat. And this woman kept screaming, "Don't leave me to die." And I shouted back that I would tell rescuers where she was. I don't know what happened to that woman or the little girl. I tried to find out and I put out an appeal, but I'm fairly sure they both died. Those people in the fishing boat rescued me. Then I was taken to land and an ambulance took me to hospital. That night I became an adult. I washed my clothes out in the sink and put them on a radiator to dry. I prayed for my mum, hoping I was praying for her and not speaking to her. That's horrendous.
Yeah, that's really horrible.
So the following day, Miss Lashbrook and her stepbrothers were told that her parents were dead and they were taken to this makeshift mortuary in a gym. I saw my dad as soon as I walked in. I saw children dead and laid out. They were children I'd seen the evening before. It didn't seem real that they were dead. Then my brother found my mum. I couldn't believe I was looking at my mum. I loved her so much and she was dead in front of me. She wasn't just my mum, she was my best friend. The night before, she'd given me some money, and just before I went on deck, she said, "Get something to eat, love, and I'll see you in a minute." And that minute never came, and that was the last time I saw her alive. A horrible thing.
Yeah, that's really
recounted
awful.
Down. But I think it's important to read that out, because I think it brings everything we said up to this point together.
Yes.
And I think it also brings home how truly horrible it is and how important it is that we don't sort of just look at these events as just something that, oh yeah, happens on the news. You think these are
real people.
Real people, yeah. Real. Oh, I don't know.
The idea of the makeshift mortuary, because that happened in the Princess Dallas disaster as well, didn't it? You've lived through the worst moments of your life and then it continues on, you know what I mean? Because of identifying the bodies, finding out who's left alive, who's not left alive. Unbelievably awful.
So that was a disaster, but how the hell could this happen? Okay, so you've got this relatively modern ship sailing in perfectly flat conditions, but this ship capsized in only 90 seconds, just over a kilometre outside the port. How could this possibly happen?
So like we said when we were talking about the horrible disaster part of this podcast, the divers saw that the bow doors were open.
Mm.
And it's this which is really, I mean, everybody remembers the bow doors were open.
It's kind of the trigger for all
this
of it.
This is the trigger.
Yeah.
Okay. The main people to remember are Assistant Bosun Mark Stanley.
Was the guy sweeping up then having a nap.
Yep. First Officer Leslie Sable.
Stressed guy who was loading on the cars.
Yeah. And the captain. He got knocked out.
Mm.
Well, those open bow doors and those people are critical in determining why this happened.
Mm.
Okay. In short, the Herald of Free Enterprise set out from Zeebrugge without closing the bow doors.
Mm.
I mean, that's literally, that's the nub and crux of the whole affair. It was the first officer, Leslie Sable's job, to supervise the loading of vehicles and to get them loaded on time. If he failed to do that, he would have been reprimanded by his bosses. They'd have fucking told him off.
Yeah, yeah.
The night of the disaster, Sable was under a lot of pressure because they were running quite late.
Mm.
They eventually got out only 5 minutes late, but that's enough for him to get shouted at, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. As Sable loads the last car onto the ship, a radio call was announced calling for harbour stations, and Sable heads up to the bridge of the ship. Now, harbour stations is the signal for the crew to go to their positions for departure.
Mm-hmm.
That's like on a plane, cabin crew, set doors to manual.
That's, yeah.
Something like that. You know,
go and do something.
Go and sit down, because we're leaving. It's also the signal to close the bow doors using a hydraulic control lever on the car deck.
Mm.
So what he should have done now is close the doors and gone to... Gone to the bridge.
Yeah. What he did do was go to the bridge and didn't close the doors.
He just went. Mm. The closing of the bow doors was a job of Assistant Bosun Mark Stanley. But when he should be on the car deck closing the bow doors, Stanley was asleep in his cabin because he was knackered. He'd done a five-hour shift. He'd been on his break, but he'd slept through the call for harbour stations.
Sounds awful, but a relatively simple thing to do.
Yeah, easy.
Mm.
Easy mistake to make, really. And it's one half a dozen of the other, isn't it? You know, he closes it, the other guy closes it, as long as somebody closes it.
Well, again, it's one of those things that officially he should have closed it, but the reality is...
But the guy who closes it,
Yeah.
It, you know, who closed it yesterday? Oh, I closed it. You close it tomorrow, all the rest of that sort of stuff. It's, you know, like any job, Steve, do you want to do it? You know, Brian, do you want to do it? Somebody's got to do it. Right?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah. Remember we mentioned a guy called Lee Cornelius who was working on it. He actually said something about this. He said, sometimes when we completed loading and left, one of the guys on the main deck would shut the bow doors, but that night we didn't and just left them open and expected Mark, the guy who was sleeping, just to come and shut them.
Because having the bow doors open doesn't sink the this is important, we come onto it later, don't we? But, like, it doesn't sink the ship.
No, that's the thing, it doesn't. And I have many years when I've got ferries, because, you know, I like big machines, I've noticed that I've been on many ferries that have gone out of port with the bow doors open and they're just closing as the ship's sailing off. Because, of course, saves time.
Yeah.
You can either sit in port waiting for those doors to close, or you can get going, save yourself a few minutes.
And it doesn't, as we'll come on to it, it's something else that has to come into play to mean it's bad.
Exactly.
But for the most part, you could probably go the most of the way, right? Or at least quite a lot of way with those doors open.
And I think this is really important because I think we all think, oh, Herald of Free Enterprise, oh, your bow doors are left open.
Yeah.
And yes, but that isn't enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I always remember thinking, how the fuck could you do it? Mm. How could you sail away with a big hole in the ship?
Yeah.
But essentially, it's like, you know, driving with your sunroof open, really.
And it wasn't uncommon.
Yeah.
It was quite normal practice, even though unofficial.
But it's not ideal, is it?
No.
And there's no fail-safe system for closing the bow doors. So it's not like an alarm goes off. Is that what you're saying there? Nothing, you know, there's nothing that goes, Jesus Christ, lads, the doors are open.
Yeah. First. Exactly that.
Have you not got that? You got that in your car? That fucking hell, mate, put your seatbelt on. That's what my car does. Jesus Christ, the boot's open. That's what my dad does.
You got a Danny Dyer.
I've got Danny Dyer's car.
Danny Dyer car.
Oh, you fucking silly bollocks. Put your seatbelt on. Okay. Even though it was Mark Stanley's job to shut them, it should have been double-checked by First Officer Leslie Sable. I mean, this is by the book. But we all know what we're really like as human beings.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think you can really blame these two. I don't feel like giving them much blame, if I'm honest. But because they were working to tight deadlines, it was quite normal practice for the First Officer to leave the car deck before the bow doors were shut, because another part of his job meant that he had to be on the bridge pretty much as soon as the last car was loaded.
Well, it's interesting because I was listening to an investigator talking about this, and he was saying, well, the way it was structured was that guy had to be in two places at once.
Oh, really?
It was really hard for him to do. He couldn't wait to see the bow doors closed and be on the bridge. So what he would normally do is just go, okay, they need to be close, get to the bridge as quick as possible. So,
yeah, this isn't his fault. This is a procedural problem.
Yeah.
Another flaw of this system that they had on the Herald of Free Enterprise is the captain couldn't see the doors from the bridge.
Mm.
So we've got no idea if they're closed or open or not.
No.
He's got no alarm saying, doors are open, mate.
No.
He can't see it. And the guy who's coming up to tell him it's all right doesn't actually know.
No.
So,
well, I was reading that the company had a policy, is if nobody says anything, it must be all right.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. That sounds perfect.
It's called I can't remember. There is a policy.
That is, ironically, exactly how problems are dealt with in my family. Okay. So you've got to put a caveat in here in case we think it's a totally unusual situation. At the time, none of this is uncommon. At all. It's not an uncommon practice to set sail with the bow doors open, like we've said. It's common practice and it's worked 4 times a day, every day.
For years. Yeah. Now, it's like I say, it's against regulations.
Yeah.
Funny enough, Townsend Torreson had a similar problem with bow doors open about 3 years before, but nothing actually...
Oh, really?
Nothing occurred.
Oh, that's a shame.
But
not a shame that nothing occurred. It's a shame they didn't learn from it.
Yeah, it's not an excuse, is it? But it is just putting this situation in context. It wasn't really allowed, but it did happen.
So what is it about having the bow doors open that caused such a problem?
So the first thing to say is that it would take thousands and thousands of tons of water entering a ship of that size to capsize it. It's a big ship. So something was clearly amiss here. Now, we've already established that the bow doors were left open when the ship set sail. So could it be that with the doors open, the sea was just coming in through the front of the ship? Well, that's, I think, what a lot of people think, but it shouldn't be that easy.
Yeah.
Because the bow doors are actually located 3.5 metres above the waterline.
A long way.
So really, with the bow doors open, water shouldn't even be getting in, certainly on a calm night.
Yeah.
The problem, though, on this night, was that the clearance between the bow doors and the waterline was reduced. Okay, so remember at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about how the captain had to pump seawater in the ship's ballast tanks to lower it so that it could
attach to the gangplank
for the cars to drive on. Well, that was one of the problems, because that ballast was not then emptied before the ship set sail.
Yeah.
So when she set off, she was already 1 metre lower than normal.
So really, those two mistakes have to happen on the same
yes.
journey.
So yes, the captain's at fault here. He should have yeah. really... But again, was it like, oh, well, you know, like it'll take me time to pump that out. Let's get going.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And even if it was, they've lowered the ship by a metre, but the doors are, well, you said 3.5 metres above. So they've still got 2.5 metres of space between an
yeah.
open part of a ship, which is more than you've got like on a rowing boat.
Yeah.
You know, which is like 30 centimetres or something. It shouldn't make...
No.
That much difference.
That's exactly it. It should still be enough, even with those problems.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we've got something else comes into play, of course, because these yeah. things all link. And this is a technical thing. And it makes the situation of 2.5 metres worse.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Zeebrugge Harbour is actually relatively shallow. It's just 15.5 metres deep. It's not very deep at all.
Yeah.
In fact, the English Channel's not very deep.
Is it not?
No, not very deep at all. It was only 20,000 years ago, it was land. Anyway, so as the ship sails, her movement forward creates low pressure under the hull of the ship
yep.
that is sucking the bow down slightly.
Yeah, because if you move something through the water, the front part goes down
yes.
and the back part goes up.
Yes.
Sticks its bum in the air.
Yeah. Now, in deep water, that effect is quite small.
Right.
But in shallow water, like Zeebrugge, remember, only 15 metres, the effect is much greater. Because of this effect, the gap is now just 1.5 metres.
Right.
But even all of this is still
oh.
not enough. And it's heading
you're
that
telling
way.
You've still got a metre.
You've still got 1.5 metres.
Right.
Okay. As the ship increased her speed, the waves got bigger and changed direction. So as you get faster with something, those waves get bigger because of the impact is bigger.
Yeah.
They hit the ship, they bounce back bigger. Now, when the ship hits 18 knots,
yep.
roughly 18 miles an hour, and that speed is absolutely critical, because at that speed, that's when the waves become consistently big enough, about 4 metres high,
yeah.
to engulf the bow doors and flood the ship. The tragedy here is that if the sea was not so shallow,
yeah.
The waves may not have been as big. So it could have gone on for ages before someone went, oh, actually, those
yeah.
doors are left open. We better shut those. So it's all, like you say, it's all these factors coming into play. But I am sorry to say this, Phil.
Oh.
Even this.
Oh, right.
Everything I've just said is still not necessarily enough.
Wow.
To sink a ship the size of the Herald of Free Enterprise. There is more.
Will someone leave a bathroom?
No, it needs one final factor. Traditionally, ships are constructed with a series of watertight compartments below the waterline.
Yep.
Okay.
So if there's a problem, they can shut it.
They shut it in one door. Yeah. Yeah. But the Herald of Free Enterprise, and to be fair, many roll-on, roll-off ferries, were not designed that way. She had this huge open car deck with no dividing walls, obviously so vehicles can quickly
yeah.
drive on and off. Now, what that meant is that with a massive open deck, 2,000 tonnes of water can just...
Nothing stopping that water whatsoever.
Yeah, it goes inside the ship, makes the ship very unstable very, very quickly.
Which is why the captain couldn't steer it.
Yes, which is why when you look at the route, the ship was going off course for about 30 seconds yeah. to a minute before the disaster as the water is slowly building up.
Yeah.
You see, as a ship sails, it naturally rocks from side to side.
Yeah.
Now, if it's taking on water, that water is surging with that rocking motion, a bit like a pendulum. Every sway makes the sway of the water coming back bigger and bigger, doesn't it?
Yeah. Sucking more water onto the boat,
yes,
I assume.
Exactly. So, with each swing of the ship, the water surges more violently, causing the ship to tilt more steeply.
Yeah.
Now, eventually, that hits a point of no return.
Yeah.
And then the ship rolls so far across in one pitch that it just can't recover and come back up. And that's
yeah.
exactly what happened.
It's horrible. It's really,
really
horrible because it's one way it differs from Tenerife is that I don't feel like anybody's really that badly to blame. Nobody's making huge mistakes.
No, it's eating.
They're not pissed. They're not watching football. You know, they're just and they're not really doing it that different from any other day, really.
Well, I think that sort of comes out in the aftermath of all this.
Yes. Needless to say, there was a public court of inquiry into the incident, and that was held under Mr. Justice Barry Sheen.
No laughing there.
I think we've done very well. It was in 1987. It concluded the sinking was caused by three main factors, Phil. One, Assistant Bosun Mark Stanley failed to close the bow doors.
I think we can agree on... Well, hang on, what am I saying? I think we can agree with the official inquiry.
No, I think... I think two blokes just sitting here are well within our rights to agree or disagree. Two, First Officer Leslie Sable's failure to make sure the bow doors were closed.
Yeah, get that.
Fair enough. Three, the captain leaving port without knowing whether the bow doors were closed.
Okay.
Fair enough. Mm. All three of these people, incidentally, had been suspended from duty immediately after the accident.
Well, that makes sense, because you need to find out what happened, so it's best not have people potentially culpable working.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
But I don't feel like these three are villains in any way.
No, I get that.
The fact that Stanley was asleep at the time of departure led Barry Sheen to examine the working practices of Townsend Torreson. From which he concluded that the poor workplace communication and standoff relationship between ship operators and shore-based managers was the root cause of the sinking.
Yes, bad industrial relations.
Yeah, man. Like, if your bosses are dicks and you don't like them, there's no communication and all the rest of that, bad stuff happens because you can't be honest with each other.
Well, old Barry Sheen said there was a disease of sloppiness and negligence at every level of Townsend Torreson's hierarchy.
Every single level,
yeah.
I mean, that's one thing. It's sloppy,
yeah,
isn't it?
Very sloppy.
And you can see it, you know, you can see the. We've all been on a ferry. We've all seen what the blokes are like. God bless them. But, you know, it's not like Lufthansa, is it? Okay. The design of the Herald of Free Enterprise was also found to be a contributing cause of the sinking, as we said.
Yeah.
As was the need to adjust the ship's bow level at Zeebrugge and a failure to readjust this before setting sail. Yeah, because they're bodging it to make sure that it works. Right?
Yeah.
It should be noted that many acts of gallantry on the night of disaster were also noted, as we said. One man, Peter Parker, received...
No, that's Spider-Man. This is a gentleman called Andrew Parker.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It should be noted that many acts of gallantry on the night of disaster were also noted. One man, Andrew Parker, received a George Medal for laying across a broken walkway and allowing 20 passengers, including his wife and daughter, to cross over his body to safety. What a dude.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. A truck driver rescued a 5-year-old girl whose whole family had died in the disaster.
Oh, God.
In total, 14 gallantry medals were awarded.
That's a lot.
In October 1987, the jury in the coroner's inquest into the incident returned verdicts of unlawful killing in 187 cases. Mm. Most people survived, though.
Most people survived. Yes.
And 7 P&O employees were charged with gross negligence and manslaughter.
Which is including Stanley, Sable and the captain.
They got charged. A case was also presented for corporate manslaughter. However, it failed when the presiding judge, Judge Turner, instructed the jury to acquit the company because the various acts of negligence could not be attributed to a controlling mind. So there's not one person whose fault it was, so it can't be corporate manslaughter. Is that fair enough?
Yeah. Must be horrible for survivors and relatives of people who died.
Yeah.
To not be able to have
someone
to blame. But you,
it's a situation that's to blame.
Yeah, from a neutral standpoint, you can kind of...
Yeah, I see
you
what you
kind
mean.
Of see, horrible as it is.
Despite the collapse of the case, though, it did set precedent for corporate manslaughter being admissible in English courts. Mm,
first time, I think.
Disaster led to a rethink of UK ferry procedures and design. I hope procedures, because it's just some sloppy shit they're doing here. Indicators now indicate the state of the bow doors on the bridge of ferries, as well as CCTV. You'd think you'd have a light. Just a light on the dashboard. You didn't even have that before. Yeah, like on my car or something. Just a light, mate. It's open, mate.
My understanding is that the captains previous to this disaster had actually asked for it, and Townsend Torreson have said, nah.
Wow. Mm. I mean, you think I could rig up a light for them.
Yeah.
A buzzer, a horn, just a ha-ha, just anything.
Anything.
Watertight ramps were fitted to bow sections at the front of ships.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the minimum height regulations for the distance between a ship's vehicle deck and the waterline had been raised. So simple.
Yeah.
Simple as almighty God living fuck. And that will save so many lives. So what happened to the ship?
Ah, the ship itself. Yeah, well, 7 weeks after the disaster, the Herald of Free Enterprise was righted and refloated again. And horribly, it was only at this point that the final bodies were able to be retrieved from the ship.
7 weeks?
Mm, that's horrible.
Christ, that's awful. But I can see why they would do it, because it hasn't crashed. Do you know what I mean? It's just rested nicely on a sandbag, so it's probably not damaged.
Well, This is the thing, you see. She was then towed to a yard in Holland, quite nearby, where her fate was to be decided. Yeah. And this is the bit I struggled to get my head around. Incredibly, it was initially assumed that she could be repaired.
Yeah.
Admittedly sold to another company.
Yeah.
But go back into service.
Yeah, repainted.
I mean,
it's
that's
weird.
Horrible to think you could do that.
But it's money, isn't it? There's a lot of money in it. It's a very, I mean, even though it's an old foot ferry, that's an expensive thing.
But it's a grave.
It's a huge grave.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
It's awful they could even consider it. I mean, thank God they couldn't find a buyer.
Yes.
Thank
well,
God nobody
yeah,
went,
buy it.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, no.
Like Dennis Nilsson's flat, isn't
yeah.
it? It's like, I'm not sure.
It was tainted, you know. Yeah. So then they decided that she would just be scrapped. So what they did is they renamed her Flushing Range for this single journey. Because it's
oh,
such a...
that's sinister, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's such a name.
Yeah.
Such association, they couldn't have it. So they renamed her and repainted.
Wow.
And gave her a different colour scheme.
Flushing Range.
Flushing Range, yeah.
What a strange name.
Yeah, it's an unusual name, isn't it? I think it's because the port in Holland was at Flushing,
oh,
I think.
Okay.
I think. Anyway, so then she was towed for a final trip to across the sea to a Taiwanese scrapyard, and she was scrapped when she finally arrived there in March 1988. But the weird thing I noticed that even the moment they raised her and she was righted again at the point of disaster, they scraped the name out.
Did they really?
Yeah, straight away, scraped the name out. Because there's just something about...
symbolic, isn't
yeah,
it? Yeah,
and in the same way, P&O immediately just... bin the Townsend Torreson name and
yeah.
painted, because there's a sister ship to the Herald, absolutely identical.
Is there?
Yeah, and that sailed carried on sailing for years afterwards.
Yeah, you would want to obliterate everything.
Absolutely obliterate. That was P&O Ferries straight away.
Yeah, you can see immediately the brand is fucked.
Yeah,
like everything is fucked. You've got to try and distance yourself as much as possible to make sure your business stays
absolutely. Afraid. And that's pretty much it. Is there anything else we need to know, though, Phil?
Ferry Aid.
Oh.
Ferry Aid.
I remember Ferry Aid.
Do you remember Ferry Aid?
The charity single.
Not the fizzy drink. Ferry Aid. I don't remember Ferry Aid.
Do you not?
No, charity single.
Yeah.
Recorded by a mixture of artists. It sounds like this.
Very much in the mould of Band-Aid, even to the point where they chucked Aid at the end of the single.
It did reach number one, though, because it's not about the song, is it?
Well, this is the thing. We can't be too hard on it because, you know, yeah.
It raised a lot of money.
It raised a lot of money for the charity that was set up after the disaster.
If you're wondering what was making that fabulous musical noise, it was Paul McCartney.
Big name.
Boy George.
Big name at the time.
Karen Woodward from Bananarama.
Not as big a name.
Nick Kamen?
Small name.
I don't know. I've never heard of Nick Kamen.
Nick Kamen did a
sort
Levi's.
Of lizard-like creature.
Levi's commercial in
oh,
the washing machine,
yeah.
Then had like one or two singles.
I remember him.
So all the big names on this one.
Paul King?
Paul King. Kiss me with your mouth. No, that's Stephen Tintin Duffy. No, Paul King. Hang on. That's where my heart works, the you love and pride.
Mark King?
Thunder Thumbs, level 42.
Oh, okay. Mark Knopfler.
Guitar solo obs.
Andy Bell?
Erasure singer.
Okay, Pepsi and Shirley.
We know them.
Mel and Kim.
Tay, Tay, Tay,
Gary Moore.
Some guitar bloke.
Unfortunately, Brighton. Dead now, of course.
Yeah.
Kim Wilde.
We're the kids in America.
Oh, Nick Kershaw, The Riddle.
By
a tree, there's a river and a man with a gun. And he's got a big hat on and he's round and around.
Ben from Curiosity Killed the Cat. Do you know any Curiosity Killed the Cat songs?
I do. Misfit, 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 reach out on the street, and obviously straight back down, down.
So it's strange
down,
with so much talent on board that it was such a bad single. But
made a lot of money,
made
so
a lot of money.
Fair play to them.
And it's nice to end such a horrible podcast with maybe something a little bit lighthearted. Phil, that was the, in the final analysis, fricking horrific Zeebrugge disaster.
Awful.
Our fault or God's fault?
It was probably the fault of the people who didn't close the bow doors.
No
but
weather.
I don't think it was any maliciousness in...
There's no weather involved in this.
No, there's
weather.
There's no God.
There's no God. Well, there is no God, says Phil Lucas. Yes, I think our fault. I think our fault.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for listening to the Zeebrugge episode of the Crash Bang Wallop podcast. How can people get in touch with us if they want to?
Good way is Twitter, at CB Wallop. We are always on Twitter. It's a good one. We've got an Instagram account.
Oh, yeah.
At Wallop Bang. If you like this, iTunes review would be wonderful. We say it every episode, but they are really helpful, and we really genuinely do appreciate them. And if you saw how excited and happy we got when we got a new review.
I mean, it's all I've got, really. It's all I've got in my life is the new... Trying to look at the new reviews.
That would be wonderful.
Have you thought about setting up the Patreon account again?
No.
Dead against the Patreon account. That.
Too much extra work with the outtakes. Extra work.
So if you want to donate £1 a week to us, you can't.
I think it is still technically going, but I really do need to close it down.
Oh really? Are you siphoning money off it? Like Robert Maxwell?
I don't think we get any money anymore. I haven't looked. I'm very behind on admin.
If you are, if there is some shadowy benefactor funneling money into our Patreon account, God bless you. What would you like us to do? Lovely. Thank you so much for listening to the Zeebrugge ferry disaster. I hope it wasn't too harrowing and was enjoyable in at least some small way. Mr. Phil Lucas, have you got anything to add?
No, but you can see I'm moving.
It's time for a wee and a drink.
I really do need the loo.
Thanks very much. We'll see you again. Goodbye.
Cheers.